Don't you know?
Places.
Don't you know?
Events.
Don't you know?
From the campus of Winona State University, KQAL FM is proud to present
Don't You Know?
Now, here with Everything Winona, here's Terry Tenseth.
Oh, don't you know?
Today on Don't You Know, we continue our coverage of the Big Muddy River Rendezvous that took place in Winona at Prairie Island Campground in the middle of a very windy October. The purpose of the rendezvous is to educate people on the life in the pre-1840s fur trading era. On this episode, we will be informed on wigwams, a Native American domed round shelter, and about different tribes that were native to Minnesota. We'll also learn an abbreviated history of tomahawks. You're listening to Don't You Know?
My name's Robert Jagosinski. Everybody calls me Holy Bob, or my native name is actually Makwe Nine Noe, which means man who walks at night. We've been demonstrating wigwams. Wigwams are Ojibwe huts. The Ojibwe actually moved all the Algonquin nations over in New York, the nowadays New York area, from New York over to here to get away from the tribes. And Algonquin people, they live in longhouses. Longhouses are bigger huts than that, and the whole family actually lives inside the domain. But now that we've split from them, we've made smaller domains, because in this area we don't have the vast forest or the space to put up the longhouses, so we've vamped the longhouse down into what you see here is our wigwams. This is the frame, and then we have our other wigwams as our shelters. Teepees were not here. The teepees that were here were actually covered in birch bark, as well as the wigwams, but they were called conicals. The wigwams are covered in canvas. The canvas nowadays is a lot lighter. It's easier to pack up in the canoes. So the canvas didn't come here till about the 1820s. Before then, it was actually covered in birch bark. Either it was covered in birch bark, it was covered in bass bark or ash bark, or also you could make cattail reeds. You sew them together and you make your cattail reeds. Sometimes it was a mixture of all three. It all depends on what time of the year it was. And you kept on moving with the meat. Wherever the game was plenty, that's where you would go. So you'd set up your huts, your shelters, wherever the meat was good or where the trade was good. So a lot of the times there was villages right next to Mr. Sayers' forts, the fur trade, Northwest Company and the XY Company of the time. Birch bark was sewn together, as well as the bass. A lot of times it was sewn with stinging nettle, as well as tied up with stinging nettle. Stinging nettle, you can twist it together. You also a hemp cord, which is twine. You can also use sinew. Sinew was not very commonly used, but it could have been used. Sinew is actually made out of the back strap. It's made out of the deer itself, but that was very uncommon for them to tie it together.
What got you involved with the rendezvous?
I've been doing it for 13 years.
Wow. Yep. Okay, you've had your time then.
It's just a passion. I walked into a rendezvous and fell in love with it. I actually walked into a historical reenactment at a fort, and I just fell in love with it. I fell in love with the history.
How many rendezvous do you do a year? Is this your main one? Or?
I do usually up to from 16 to 22 a year.
Wow. Okay. So it keeps you busy, and they're about a week in length each, right?
Well, yeah. Sometimes, a lot of times, I just do them in weekend spurts. Keep the cost down.
And are most of these for educational purposes?
All educational purposes. A lot of times, like, okay, you have your structure here. You have your wigwam. When the Ojibwe moved, or most of the trading was done by the rivers. So what you'd have to do is you'd do a canoe. You travel by canoe. Well, if you weren't going to stay there long, you wouldn't put up your tent. So what you do is you sleep under your canoe, doing a canoe camp, and that's usually how I sleep, because I'm moving from vast, and the canoes were also made out of birch bark.
And you camp here the entire time?
Yes.
Exactly. Where are you from originally?
I'm from Coon Rapids, Minnesota.
Okay, so you're a Minnesota boy.
Yeah.
So what goes into your research, and how often do you reevaluate how you're teaching?
I learn from an elder, so I learn from somebody who was raised on the reservation building wigwams. So I really don't re-reference any of it, because there's only one way to really put up these domains. I mean, as long as you get your sticks in shape, I mean, there's no wrong way to put it up.
Right.
You know, you have a home. That's all that's really important. That's all that was really important to them. As long as you have a stable structure, that's more sound than anything else. And the women owned the huts. The men hunted and protected, and they actually slept next to the door, but the women owned everything inside. The only thing that the men owned was the clothes on them, and they're gone.
How long would it take to put one up, Oleglon?
Up 2 hours.
It's not bad.
No, not with the canvas. Birch bark, you'd be spending a good portion of your day.
I mean, this could sleep a family of four. And a lot of times when the birch bark wigwams.
Okay, so you'd have your fire here, and you'd have your smoke hole in the middle.
Okay.
And you'd have your fire coming up, blowing your smoke. You'd have a tube come outside, and you'd have your fire. So there would actually be a live fire in here if it was a birch bark. But this is a quick setup. This is one that's more mobile.
Makwe Nine Nowe invited me into his wigwam, and we got into a discussion about the different items he had inside. Some needles, hides, things of that nature. And then we got into talking about how in the Native American culture, everything from the animal is used.
You use everything. You keep the hides for bed, hides for trade. You use the bones for tools. And you keep on doing that. Like if you're to cut down a tree, you use all the tree, not just for firewood. You can make utensils, so you make a bowl, or need a fork today, so you make a fork. And you know, you only take the resources that you really need. And when you harvest the trees for like the wigwams, when they're doing birch or ash or bass, when they're harvesting the bark, they only harvest so much bark off of certain trees because they don't want the tree to die. So you take a certain section off, and 25 years regrowth, a birch bark will regrow its bark that you can harvest it. So every 25 years you can reharvest a birch bark tree.
That's great.
Yeah.
It takes a while to figure out, I guess, how much bark you need.
But, right.
Yeah.
But I mean, the trees back
huge.
Then were huge.
Makwe Nine Nowe lifted the sleeve on his left arm to show me a tattoo on his forearm. The tattoo was in black ink that had turned a dark indigo. At the base of the tattoo was a line that went all the way around the wrist with an accompanying line above that to form a border. Above that, extending a little bit more than halfway up his forearm and wrapping around, were the outlines of triangles. The tips of the triangle met with the border above the wrist. The base of the triangles were met with another border, the same design of the border at the wrist. That's where the design ended. Makwe Nine Nowe goes on to explain the origin of his tattoo, which traces back to Native American culture.
Okay, and how were those made?
Ink. And
well,
needles.
Like tattoo shop or like old school?
Well, they started out old school.
Okay.
And these are actually kind of more of an Algonquin style tattoo. They're still kind of Eastern, but they're still set in this area because we came from the Algonquin, so there was still some of the presence here up till, I'd say, probably about the 1820s. Of course, we were battling this area for the Sioux back and forth all the time. The Ojibwe and the Chippewa were down in this area. I say more Chippewa, but there was the Ojibwe. It was a mixed family in this area.
And now I think the Sioux go by Dakota, right? Or Lakota?
Well, okay. Okay, there's Dakota.
Right.
There's Sioux, which they're actually two different separate ones. But see, when the nations came together, I'm actually, in all theory, Anishinaabe, but that's a Cherokee.
Okay. Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different, I don't know if you want to call it sects.
No, it's, I want to say, it's like a family.
Right.
You live in a culture, you trade with certain people, and you basically become a big family. So you network under the same one, I'd say like a bigger name.
Okay.
But you're still in your, like Anishinaabe, you say that, I mean, that's a Cherokee derivative, but it's still Ojibwe, it's Cherokee, it's actually Lakota.
Right.
So, you know, that's three different subcultures.
So there's big one, and then there's the subdivision.
Kind of.
As it goes down.
Yep.
Okay.
And I don't necessarily know when that came around, so I really can't
right.
describe that. But I know like the Mohawk, the Endowete, and the Shawnee, and there's two other ones, had an imaginary longhouse, and they were five nations that lived under one. And that's actually Ben Franklin lived with them,
And that's how the Constitution actually got written. So, I mean, that's how the most of the Constitution, one nation living under God, because these five troops, five different people, five different nations were coming together under one house, under our God. A lot of it, I mean, some of it, I can't really reference this, but a lot of it, I think, is some of these cultures were coming together and forming a bigger cultural name when the white man started coming in and taking apart the lands. I can't really
cite it.
Right.
Right. No, I get it.
But I have a funny feeling that some of it was because of that. Because, I mean, like, if you look, Ojibwe is an Algonquin-speaking tribe. And Algonquin's over in New York, and there's a lot of tribes in between that are Algonquin-speaking tribe. It's like listening to someone who speaks Spanish. Okay, I'm an Algonquin-speaking nation. That's what our language comes from, is Algonquin-speaking tribe. But if you take someone who lives in Mexico from someone who lives in Puerto Rican, they speak Spanish, but their language is different. It's the same base language, but they use different words.
That happens in Polish language too.
Right.
It happens, I mean, if you look at Portuguese versus Spanish, yeah, they sound the same. Yep.
But Spanish is so much easier to reference,
right,
because you hear a lot of Spanish.
Right.
So it's easier to reference something to somebody that they know. Because, I mean, you could use any language around here that was spoken in any nation. It all depends on where you went. Like, the poor people aren't going to talk like the rich people, so they're going to be using different words. But the Spanish language is easier to use because a lot of people hear the different dialects because it's so here. But, I mean, like, when Cadians or when even Indians were learning French, their French was way different than the French that you were hearing from the people that lived over in France, but they could understand it because they knew it.
Right.
But it was not French. It was like a mixed language.
Well, thanks. That's
up next. We have a short piece explaining a little bit of history on the tomahawk. When I was at the Big Muddy River Rendezvous this year, I did try my hand at throwing the tomahawk, and I will tell you personally, it looks easier than it seems. It took me 5 tries before I was able to hit a piece of wood that was maybe 6 paces away from me.
I'm Rod Cowton. I'm from Parkersburg, Iowa. I come here every year to teach the kids how to throw trade tomahawks. They're the same tomahawks, or very similar to what the French would trade with the Indians. Help the Indians get away from stone tools and get to use metal tools so they could process hides faster so that the French could make more money.
You're showing the kids how to throw correctly, right?
Yes, as best as we know how.
So what would be the main things to keep in mind when trying to throw a tomahawk and aiming for a target?
Aiming is a little difficult, but basically the stance and to grip the tomahawk properly and then the proper follow through. Just like throwing any other object, you gotta get all 3 of those and then everything else just comes natural.
And how long have you been working perfecting your throw?
I started about 15 years ago and was terrible and worked up. In the last 5 years, I've worked into teaching kids at several locations. I've cleared down to Bonham, Texas through western Wisconsin and southeastern Minnesota.
The wind started taking over, and my microphone didn't pick up the next question. But at this point, I asked, how long have tomahawks been around? Does anybody know?
Well, they actually got copper tomahawks they found clear back to before man actually started keeping track of that kind of stuff. They found them with a guy over in Europe. They found frozen up there in the mountains. He had a crude tomahawk weapon with him. So nobody knows when it actually started. The forged tomahawks probably started in the late 1500s, I'm guessing. And they brought over the metal axes with them to the Plymouth area when the Pilgrims landed. And they, through the years, have just been perfected better and better.
Great. What is it you like about being at the Rendezvous?
Oh, I like working with the kids. The kids, the first time that they stick the tomahawk, or like when I do fire starting, first time that they sit there and get fire from a rock and a hunk of iron, it just watched their face light up, and that's the fun part.
A big thank you to Makwe Nene Nwe and to Rod Gowton for sharing with us the lifestyle of the pre-1840s fur trading era at the Big Muddy River Rendezvous. thank you to all the participants who made our visit very interesting and educational.
Thanks for listening to Don't You Know? Support for this program is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Don't You Know is produced by KQAL-FM to keep you up to date on the people, places, and events in and around Winona. Visit us online at kqal.org.